The last installment of a year-long series of lectures and seminars initiated by graduate students under the elegant rubric, Renewing Socialism for the 21st Century, Alternatives to Capitalism, and How to Get There. The strength is more on the thinking of these issues rather than the how to get there part, I think, in terms of the insights that have been coming in the course of the year. Progress on how to actually get there has been slower than how to think about where we want to go and why we want to leave where we are. But that's, I think, reflecting part of the big dilemmas of our times. Vivek Chibber is a PhD from Wisconsin. I have the pleasure for the first time ever being able to read from an acknowledgement in a book I wrote to a speaker at the Haven Center. And I quote, although there's a certain theoretical issue in my acknowledgement which Vivek takes issue with, which I will briefly comment on. My former student Vivek Chibber has repeatedly reminded me that class struggle and class politics must be at the core of efforts to transform and transcend capitalism. Even though he, I think, now reluctantly agrees with me that ruptural logics of class struggle are not very plausible in the world today. Now, the part that he takes exception to is he says that he never thought that ruptural logics of class struggle were very plausible, not just in the world today, and that to make this a little bit more apropos, maybe the expression should be changed. Even though I now reluctantly agrees with me that super confrontational, no compromise logics of class struggle are not very plausible in the world today. Or something like that. He is the author of an astoundingly good book on the problems of and dilemmas of the development state called Locked in Place, a study specifically focused on the impasse of development in the Indian state with comparisons especially to the South Korean state. He will be talking tomorrow more on work that's embedded in his forthcoming, almost completed or soon to be finished book. And today he will be talking, and I didn't get the title, Socialism and Development, Cause or Consequence. There'll be another lecture tomorrow in the Lake Room, and then on Thursday, an open forum discussion seminar to raise any issues that come out of these lectures or side issues that occur to you in the course of our discussions. Vivek.
Thank you, Eric, and the Haven Center, and especially the students of the Haven Center for organizing this series. The Haven Center, it's a real pleasure to be back in large measure because the Haven Center is such a unique, or as Americans might say, a very unique place in American academia. It's an oasis for progressive thought in this culture, in academic life today, which is almost impossible to replicate anywhere else. I say that only because to prepare you for the fact that this talk is going to be a disappointment at many levels for you. The first is that Eric said that one of the ambitions of this series is to discuss ways out of capitalism and into socialism. And my talk is going to be rather pessimistic about that, at least with regard to the developmental areas of the world, both in explaining their experience and also where we are currently. But I'm also going to venture out of the developmental areas, the backward, economically backward areas, and give a very pessimistic set of prognoses about chances for socialist transitions in the advanced world as well. So I'm very sorry, let me say right now, for the bad news. But it's God's work, not mine. I'm just a messenger. The second thing is, in preparing this talk, I have to say, it's the toughest talk I've ever had to try to prepare because, and I complained to the students about this some time back, and they were unyielding. So there was no choice. I said, I don't know what to say about, you know, usually when one gives talks, one tries to explain things. And with socialism and development, it's either a prescriptive talk about how the world ought to be, and yeah, I can say anything about that. But there's nothing to hold on to. or it'll just be largely an account of what happened in the past, and there too it's probably stuff you already know. So, but the students wouldn't change their mind, and so I'm stuck with giving a talk which I'm not sure how much it's going to actually reveal aspects of either the history or the dynamics of the subject which you aren't already aware of. That said, let me give you a sense of where we're headed. The two talks I'm going to give are related to each other, and they're related in the following way. Today's talk is going to be on what we've seen happen in the world across the 20th century in attempts to meld socialism in a developmental context. That talk is going to be about basically a series of defeats that socialists and the socialist experiment underwent in this context. It's going to end with a more pessimistic note to the effect that the defeat has not only been felt across the developing world, but for those people who think the chances of any kind of post-capitalist transition, unless you define post-capitalism the way Eric does, which is incremental, but if you take a post-capitalist transition to be more of a leap into a social system with entirely different logics, the advanced world is farther away from that today than it was probably 100 years ago, which means that we are sort of, as progressives, those of us who count ourselves in the anti-capitalist left, we're sort of, I don't want to say we're back to square one, but we're very far from where we'd like to be. Okay, that's where we'll end today. Tomorrow's talk will take up the following subject, which is, well, if now we have to rethink some strategic, organizational, and political dimensions of the socialist project, how do we do so? Well, one precondition for doing so is to clear away the detritus that's accumulated over the years on the left. And one large heaping pile of nonsense that's accumulated on the left is a body of thought called post-colonial theory. And the core of tomorrow's talk will be that today the face of radicalism in academic life is postmodernist, post-structuralist, and for anybody interested in the developing world, it's post-colonial theory. That is the face of radicalism. And one of its claims to fame has been to have inherited the mantle of the socialist tradition, a tradition which it seeks, which it says not only failed, but had to have failed, because its basic understanding of the world, its basic framework, was so fundamentally flawed. What I will do tomorrow is to say that whatever else the socialist tradition's flaws were, it's not what post-colonial theory says they were. And I will offer both a rendering of some of the core arguments of post-colonial theory, and then a defense of the basic Marxist framework, at least those aspects which they bring up, against their criticisms. That is all towards saying that even though we are few in number, lacking power, and lacking organizations, that's no excuse to lack good sense. And tomorrow, hopefully, will be one step towards building some kind of, at the very least, an intellectual framework to help us move forward. So that's where we are. The Thursday seminar, I don't know what you guys do, but I'll show up, and whatever people want to talk about there, we can talk about that. So that said, let's proceed with today's talk, which is titled Socialism Development Cause or Consequence. And that title is to convey a kind of, an irony, because for socialists in Marxist time, what the connection was between development and socialism was quite clear. Development was to be a precondition to any attempt at socialism. For Marx, the socialism meant, if nothing else, two things. The democratization of not just political life, but also economic life. So that the producers of goods actually had a say through whatever instruments, whatever mechanisms would be developed, in what was produced and how it was produced, and, of course, the conditions of its production. So first of all, there would be a democratization of economic life. Secondly, he was quite clear, socialism, if it means anything, means a reduction of working time. So that humans, he used the word man, but man's multifold dimensions of his personality, of her capacities, could be developed outside the workplace. And whereas Marx considered creative labor to be core to human nature, it's really the creative part of it, not the labor part of it, that deserves emphasis here. Laboring activity is, of course, an expression of human creativity, but it is simply one expression. And for Marx, it was quite clear that for the other dimensions of human personalities to develop, it would have to occur outside the workplace. Well, both of these things presumed a very high level of development of the productive forces. For the democratization of economic life, planning would be necessary in some way. And Marx considered it one of the effects of capitalism, the positive effects of capitalism, to have centralized production, to have highly concentrated it in a few hands, to have socialized it through finance, and basically have laid the foundations so that productive units were large enough, had a big enough impact on the economy that a small number of productive, relatively speaking, small number of productive units could be planned and coordinated in a way that had a large impact on the economy. But for economies that were characterized by innumerable peasant producers, small firms, small businesses, it would be that much harder to plan them. Secondly, the productive forces would have to be quite high in their development in order to minimize production time. Productivity, in other words, would have to be high enough that the working week could be progressively reduced without it having to come at the cost of people's living standards. But if living standards are already so low that people have to spend 10, 12, 14 hours a day just to get by, then there's no question of reducing that working time without a catastrophic drop in their standards of living. So for Marx, it was quite clear that socialism presumed a very high level of development of the productive forces. He took that as... Now, he wasn't dogmatic about that. And at the end of his life, when Russian populists got in touch with him asking if Russia could perhaps skip over capitalism, he took that question seriously. But he didn't take it seriously in that he thought that the practical dilemmas of a backward country could be ignored or done away with in Russia. He just thought the peasant commune could be a way of actually engineering development in such a way that it could bring together the positives of socialism and a highly developed economy. Well, he never got very far in thinking about this, but it showed that it wasn't simply an article of faith for him, a first principle, that you have to have a high level of development. It was, however, a working hypothesis, and he took it pretty seriously. The dilemma for Marx and for Engels and for all socialists of his time, the practical dilemma, was a political one. And that was, while we might have some conception of what it takes to make a workable socialism, how do we get there? The politics of socialism was what was at something of a puzzle for all socialists then. And by the time Engels died in 1894, within the socialist political population, there were two paths that were being debated. One was what I think Marx and Engels themselves largely took for granted, I should say. Once again, it came out of their historical experience. It was not a religious commitment. But what they took for granted was that the proletarian revolution would be sort of like the revolutions of 1848 or 1789. It would embody a ruptural break with capitalism. The other path that was being bandied about, more towards the turn of the century, was one which took seriously the possibility of a more incremental movement towards socialism. And you all know this is Edward Bernstein's view. And this was both of these paths were debated and discussed. Neither was really, it wasn't clear which one was more realistic at the time. And in the event, what happened, of course, was that across the early to mid parts of the 20th century, it was the ruptural path to socialism that seemed to be the one that was more plausible. It was in countries where revolutions took place, where there was a revolutionary break with capitalism, that you saw some attempt at a socialist economy, at socialist organization. But this came with a cost. The first one was that it meant that socialist transitions, the countries where political opportunities for socialism were the most ripe, were the most opportune, were the ones where the economic possibilities for socialism were the most forbidding. And so it went exactly against what Marx and Engels had thought would be the necessary condition for socialism to be viable. Now, this wasn't just a historical irony. My view is that it came at a great cost. It had a pretty serious consequence. And that consequence was that by the end of the experiment, it was clear that rather than being a precondition for socialism, it was socialism that ended up being a means for engineering development. The causal relation between the two was reversed. There was a consequence that came with reversing this causal relation between the two. And the consequence, I think, was that in the end, not just the relation between the two, but the actual content of socialism ended up being transformed. And it ended up being transformed, I think, in some measure because of the backwardness of the areas in which it was attempted. What the appropriate causal language is to characterize the relation between the context of socialist transitions, that is, these backward countries, and the ultimate transformation of its content, I'm not exactly sure. And this is something we should take up in discussion. It's not clear to me that there was a deterministic relation between the two, in that it was necessarily the case that attempts at socialism in backward countries would generate the outcomes we've seen. But it is no doubt the case that those backward conditions contributed to the outcomes we've seen. How they contributed to those outcomes, I think, is an object of discussion. What I want to do is simply stipulate that there was a causal relation, leave it as a black box as to what its characterization, what its character was, and bring that out in discussion a little bit, I hope. The transmission channels that connected the forbidding economic conditions of backward countries to the eventual outcome were, I think, three. That is to say, I think there were three paths, three routes through which, three reasons that it was backwardness that ended up defeating socialism instead of socialism defeating the backwardness. The first was pretty clear. Because of the conditions in which the revolutions took place, and we're talking here about Russia and China primarily, because these were the two countries that have been and were the most influential and the most portentous in the socialist experiment. But the arguments I'm making also cover Eastern Europe, Southeast Asia, Vietnam, and Cuba. In all these countries, because of the conditions in which the revolution occurred, the first order of priority became development, prioritizing simple development over what Marx and Engels had thought would be the main priority, which would be democratization. Because socialism was being attempted in countries where the basic challenge was one of simple livelihoods, the first task for all socialist regimes ended up being accelerating the pace of development so as to raise people's standard of living. This meant that planning, socialist planning, took on a very specific hue. It became geared not to decentralizing power and decentralizing decision-making per se, but to raising the level of aggregate investment in the economy. Now, in backward countries, raising the level of investment cannot mean anything else but lowering or controlling the level of consumption. So first of all, if increasing development meant raising the level of investment, it also meant, at least counterfactually, suppressing consumption, because national savings had to be geared towards one thing or the other. But of course, suppression of consumption meant what? Pent-up demand, shortages, and an incredible demonstration effect coming from capitalist countries, which made consumers in socialist countries constantly aware of the fact that the goods, insofar as the goods were being delivered to them, were both shoddy and fewer in number. Now, this raised a legitimacy issue, which I'll come to in a second. But understand that the shortages and the deprioritization of consumption meant that the state, instead of being downsized, instead of being dismantled, actually had to be strengthened. It had to be strengthened not just as a planning body, but as an allocative body of consumer goods. Shortages meant necessarily some kind of rationing. The rationing had to be done, or was done, through the state. But precisely because it was done through the state, it also ended up undermining democratic relations, because it gave lots of space for patronage, for clientelism, and for corruption. So the prioritizing of development ended up having two drastic effects for the socialist vision. One was it deprioritized many of those components which Marx had thought would be necessary for the development of the human personality. And it gave rise to a state apparatus in which functionaries got their power by actually maintaining and controlling supplies of goods to the population and set themselves up against the interests of the population. This wasn't purely a consequence of the need to increase people's standard of living or investment. Backwardness also figured into this through a second route, which was geopolitics. It made a huge difference that revolutions occurred in backward and weak countries like Russia or Vietnam or China or Cuba, and not in countries like the United States or England or Canada, for the simple reason that backward countries could actually, the more advanced countries could contemplate undermining the socialist attempts in backward countries through military force. Military force against a country like Cuba or Vietnam is more easily contemplated than if you're thinking of overthrowing, let's say, the French, a socialist government in France, or a socialist government in the United States. Geopolitics ended up impinging on these countries in a way that it probably would not have happened had the revolutions occurred in the more advanced countries. But precisely because it did, there was no way around the fact that all these regimes had to devote a large portion of their savings to building up defense. Again, instead of going towards people's consumption or towards the ordinary things that the population would have demanded for its standard of living. Both of these ended up, therefore, creating regimes in which the first priority was investment, not consumption and not leisure. Secondly, the first effect is it prioritizes development above all else. As a corollary to this, the second point, it deprioritizes democracy. Now, it's important not to exaggerate this. There were attempts at workers' committees in the industrial sector, at peasant communes, etc. But the point is not that such organizational changes were not made. The point is that when there was a conflict between the increasing productivity or increasing production and deepening democracy, the priority, the antecedent priority to accelerating development meant that the decision would go in favor of production and in favor of productivity rather than in favor of leisure or democracy. Now, this had the effect of increasing the concentration of power within the state, naturally. It added another fillip to increase the increased concentration of power. But the second thing it did was that it changed the state's main source of legitimacy from the imagined one of Marx and Engels, where the main source of legitimacy would be extension of democracy into the economy. It extended the state's legitimacy, it made the state's main source of legitimacy to be simply increasing people's standard of living or increasing the pace of economic development. This is a slightly distinct point from the one I made earlier. The point for the state source of legitimacy, the point that I'm trying to make is that if its source of legitimacy comes from increasing the pace of development, then the state's resources will go towards ensuring that the forms of knowledge that it creates, the organizational resources that it tries to build up, all go towards that end, and not the end of experiments like the Porto Alegre experiment in Brazil, which was geared towards a democratization of the budget. The state, if you look at Russian and Chinese intellectual history, and if you look at the advances that were made in Russian science, in Russian social science, in Russian economic theory, all their main legacies are technocratic and economic. Economic is what we would say productivist. How you plan better. But plan, what does it mean to plan better? How you raise the level of investment. How you increase allocative efficiency. Not towards how you increase how you find ways of dealing with decentralized decision making. Not towards how you disperse power in a planning setting. The main models that they bequeath to us from Feldman, from Preobrazhensky, these are all highly economistic models. At least I believe this is a direct consequence of the deprioritization of development, of the states looking at economic logics as being its main source of legitimacy. The third consequence, which I think added to the difficulties of socialism and which ended up changing the content of socialism, was in the changing conception of political organizations and political parties in these countries. Socialism was supposed to be an organic expression of working class interests. I know Marx often uses a Hegelian language to talk about this, and it's expressed as a kind of teleology or as an enactment of the master-slave dialectic and all that. And you can do that if you want to, you know, I suppose, publish some articles. But his concern for, his insistence on the importance of the working class, I think, was pretty simple. It was twofold. One was that this is the only agency in capitalism that constantly confronts capital every day. So the pursuit of its interests puts it in an antagonistic relationship with the main power center in society. So that's a political reason why he thought the working class is important. And the other was that the working class is in a position to organize itself in a way that leans in a socialist direction. Socialization of its conditions of life and socialization of production are immediately in its own interest. In a way that peasant, if you give peasants their spontaneous demands, they don't gravitate towards socialism in the same way. So for Marx and Engels, for Kautsky, and indeed for Lenin, the understanding up to 1917 of the relationship between a political organization and its social base is one of a kind of fusion. The working class on its own came into conflict with capital, and political parties that were the parties of this class would develop their ideology and would develop their strategy through the practical experiences of this class. The underlying vision here was that the class would be a check, as it were, experimental ground, a practical experimental ground for the various ideas and the strategic conceptions that the party would come up with. The class, in other words, was to be a sort of check on the party. Now, in the conditions where socialism actually developed, one of two things was always the case. In Russia, it was actually true that the Bolshevik Party did develop its strategic orientation and its political ideology largely through its experience within industrial districts. Of all the parties in the Soviet pre-revolutionary Russia, the Bolsheviks probably had the deepest roots within the Russian working class. But by the end of the Civil War in Russia, that part of the class which the Bolshevik Party had been in closest contact with and which was the most class conscious and which was the politically the most mature and the most far-seeing was largely decimated. They had been the volunteers that came into the Russian army. A lot of them were killed off. A lot of them were simply dispersed. So by the time that the actual building of a Soviet state starts up around 1922 or so, the political base of the Bolshevik Party was quite different from what it used to be, and the country had largely deindustrialized. So that's one consequence that socialists in these backward countries had to deal with. A second condition that they had to deal with regard to the working class was that it wasn't decimated so much as they simply had no base in it at all. And here the Chinese experience comes to the fore. Until 1927, the Chinese Communist Party was still largely a working class party. But after they're kicked out of Shanghai and after they're kicked out of the cities through Chiang Kai-shek's pogroms in 1927 and they go to the countryside, they really start becoming a party of the peasantry in terms of their social base. Now, what's interesting here is two points. The first is that by the time the Chinese party goes into the countryside, the ideology of socialism has changed to the point where Mao and his leadership isn't all that bothered by this. It isn't all that bothered by the fact that it's now going to be a party of the peasantry. And why is that? I think the roots go back to the Russian experience. And I think what happens with the Russian experience is the Bolsheviks end up making a virtue of necessity. So by the time of the 1920s, when the Civil War is over, already by that time, the Bolsheviks have ceased to see themselves as an extension of the working class. They now start to see themselves as a patron of the working class. This has important consequences, of course. The main one is that instead of the class being a check on the party sees itself as a check on the class. It sees itself now as the guarantor of the classes, of the integrity and the viability and the acceptability of the demands that the class is bringing up. In practice, what this means is being a socialist party ends up being an expression of ideology rather than the expression of a connection with a social base. So what it takes to be a socialist ideology now is hewing to something called a socialist program. But where does the program come from? It now comes from the party. Because the party ends up now being the repository of the correct line, of the truth, of what socialism is. A very different conception of the party than what Kautsky and Lenin had held up to 1914. My wife's listening to my lecture, and she always tells me when I'm making a mistake, and this must be one of those occasions. Why won't it stop? Okay, it's fine. The Chinese Communist Party inherits this tradition, a new tradition. By the time the Chinese leave in 1927, there's something called Leninism. And Leninism by 1927 has become something that's quite different from what Bolshevism, I believe, had been in 1914. So by the time Mao goes to the countryside, they would like, I think, to be based in labor, in industrial labor, but they don't see it as a deep flaw that they're not. By the time of the 1960s, of the national liberation movements in Africa, in Vietnam, even this memory is mostly gone. And I think that you see the biggest sign of this in Amilcar Cabral's work in Guinea-Bissau. Cabral wrote this book where he says, you know, well, we wanted to be Marxists, we wanted to be socialists, but there's no working class in Guinea-Bissau. So what do we do? And he says, without any real sense of irony, he says, we essentially went out looking for some kind of part of the Guinea-Bissau population who we could call workers. Because once we established connections with them, we could have legitimacy as a working class party. So it becomes something that mechanical and that tokenistic by the 1970s. The whole conception of a party has now become one of basically intellectuals with the right line, and not organizers of a particular part of the population with particular sorts of interests. The consequence is, first of all, it eases the transition to socialism being an authoritarian ideology, because the party is now seen as the guarantor of everything that's correct, that's desirable. But within the inheritors of the Bolshevik tradition, which by the 70s and 80s, parties with a mass base in the Third World are all Maoist parties. Trotskyists don't, except for Sri Lanka, Trotskyists don't have much of a base. For Maoists, the entire conception of where socialist ideas come from is now very different from what the Second International's or the Bolshevik conception had been in the early 20th century. For Bolsheviks and for Kautskyites, the conception of socialist ideology had been that it is an extension of and a fine-tuning of the working class's demands, working class's struggles within the production process. For Mao and for Maoists, I should say especially for Maoists in the 1970s and 80s, socialism becomes more akin to consciousness raising. What you can make anyone a socialist. It's just a matter of educating them. Well, the educators, of course, are the party. So now, the fact that you're in backward parts of agrarian countries where all your base is a peasantry, whose spontaneous and natural demands are not anything that could be in line with a socialist state, it's not a problem, because you just have to educate them about it. So what this kind of socialism ends up being is a kind of hyper-voluntarism about what is and is not possible. And it's no longer based anymore in a conception of people's interests. It's based really in a conception of consciousness and changing consciousness. And as an aside, I should say, if you look at the intellectual lineage of post-structuralists in the 1980s, they all came out of Maoism. And this is where it comes from. The voluntarism, the valorization of agency over structure, the insistence on the importance of ideas, of discourse, it comes out of Maoism. Well, the changing conception of the party then ends up having a very neat and synergistic relationship with the antecedent conditions which I laid out earlier. Because once you prioritize investment, once you've deprioritized democracy, once you've strengthened the state in order to facilitate all these things, it is a natural marriage between those imperatives and a conception of socialism in which it is the party that's the repository of all things good, not its social base. The consequence was that in really existing socialism by the 1970s, the conception of socialism has basically become technocratic. that it is a plan, an exercise in planning, and its preferability over capitalism is no longer the fact that it will extend democracy into areas that capitalism will never allow. What makes it preferable is that it's more efficient. Capitalism is irrational because of the market mechanism, because of the anarchy of the market, and the superiority of socialism comes from its greater rationality. Well, I think actually this is true by the 50s. I'll come back to that in a second. But there's a difficulty that socialists had to deal with once they started selling socialism on this point, which was that it wasn't true. It turns out that capitalism ended up, at least this version of socialism, the socialism we saw in the Soviet Union, in China, in Cuba, in Vietnam, was nowhere near as efficient as capitalism. It is true that from in the Soviet Union and in China, from about 1930 to 1970, their economic story is quite impressive. On a world historic scale, they managed to grow fairly rapidly. But they managed to grow rapidly, I mean, for those of you who study development theory, because of the reasons that Arthur Lewis thought development is easy in a backward setting, which is what they were basically doing was they were just putting down new plant and equipment without worrying too much about the efficiency of the plant and equipment. There was all this surplus labor in the countryside. In China, it's still there. And that surplus labor could be sucked up into these factories and show up as huge increases in both production and in productivity. But once you hit the barrier of the labor supply, now GDP had to be increased through increases in productivity, otherwise rising wages would suck up all your resources. This is the point at which the Soviet economy really faced severe difficulties, and this is the point which the Chinese economy was facing by the late 70s. And the response on the part of both was to opt for capitalism. Different ways. In the Soviet Union, they did it by inviting in Jeffrey Sachs and killing off a bunch of their population. In China, they did it through what we're seeing now, which is a kind of market Stalinism. You know, the same bureaucratic oligarchy presiding over a slow privatization of the economy. But the belief that socialism would prove superior to capitalism on efficiency grounds so far has not been borne out. Where it did experience a great deal of success was in the developing world, not so much to socialists, but to capitalists. Capitalists in the developing world were quite enthusiastic about planning of a certain kind, and this is what I talk about in my book. And what made middle-class intellectuals and technocrats in the third world really happy about socialism was they took from it tools which enabled them to not have to try a ruptural break with capitalism, but which would accelerate the pace of capitalist development in their countries. A personal anecdote, I grew up in an unusual set of circumstances. You know, I grew up in India, and I didn't know anybody who wasn't a socialist till I was 18. And my family was very left-wing, and they were all activists and all that. And I remember all the conversations when I was growing up around socialism and all that. And it was all about planning, about the importance of planning and the superiority of planning. It was rarely about democracy. For progressives in the third world, it was the chance of pushing around capitalists but without eradicating them, of building a state sector and seeing themselves as the sort of the protectors of the state sector, and for accelerating the pace of development. This is what they took away from those lessons. So the irony is, in the third world, socialism ended up being, and socialist intellectuals ended up being, and still are, the main Indian Marxist today, this characterizes them, I think, to a T, they're the organic intellectuals of a state bureaucracy, not of anything else. So by the 70s, anyway, that particular selling point for socialism, the history had given the lie to that. Its main inheritance then, the main bequeathment of the socialist transition was, unfortunately, for much of the world, for the developing world, it was capitalist planning. Not much else. I suppose I'm being a little hyperbolic there, but we can. There were other, I suppose, legacies that are worth saving, but there are few, I think. What socialism ended up being in that part of the world, therefore, was a long road to capitalism. Russia is now capitalist. China might as well be. It soon will be. And Cuba, it's probably just a matter of time. What about, then, just to add on to the pessimism. I had said in the early 20th century there were two paths out of capitalism that were contemplated. One was a ruptural one, one was an incremental one. What happened to the incremental one? Well, the ruptural one was overwhelmed, I think, by one set of circumstances, which was the backwardness of these countries. The incremental one was overwhelmed by another set of conditions. The incremental path had seen its mission as being one of a gradual taming of capitalism through encroaching on capitalist prerogatives through parliamentary politics, through the state. This was the historical mission of social democracy. The inheritors of the Second International, the Kautskyan program in the Second International. By the 1980s, social democracy was clear that social democracy had given up the goal of actually taming capitalism. It had brought about a different kind of capitalism. But it had also, by the 80s, social democratic parties across the advanced capitalist world had internalized the basic mission of state managers in capitalism, which was to give first order of priority to profits and to the interests of their local capitalists. This was true in the 80s. It's far more true now. I think since the late 90s into this crisis, if you look at the German Social Democratic Party, if you look at French Social Democrats, the British Labour Party, and even the Swedes, the idea of these parties doing anything to upset the apple cart, to actually threaten capitalist interest, it's laughable right now. The German Social Democratic Party is a kind of a third-way Blairite soft neoliberal party. I don't know that much about what the Swedes are doing, but from what I gather, it's not too pretty. Both models, therefore, out of capitalism right now, are, shall we say, in abeyance, if not in outright defeat. Well, I have one more pessimistic thing to say, but it's actually ended up being a longer talk than I expected. Let me just say a final thing. So what this leaves open is the possibility of marrying the two. A ruptural break from capitalism occurred in the most backward countries. An incremental path of capitalism was tried in the advanced countries. Both failed. Perhaps one way out is to try to bring the ruptural path out of capitalism into the advanced countries. I think for the Eric's generation of leftists, that it's a new left, the part that considered itself a revolutionary left, or this is the hope to which they've held on, I think. And it's a good one. I'm fully supportive of it. I just don't think it's anywhere on the horizon. What's happened in the 20th century was the countries which developed capitalism also underwent two other changes. That capitalism became one that is quite hegemonic. It's a capitalism that is unlike Russian capitalism and Chinese capitalism, which had no real base of support within the population. These countries do. Organizing, therefore, in these countries is no simple task, and Gramsci realized this back in the 20s. But even more importantly, alongside the development of capitalist economy was the development of the capitalist state. And to contemplate a breakdown of the state, either a political breakdown or its logistical breakdown right now, is, I think, something of a fantasy. There's revolutions, you know, you don't flip a switch and make a revolution. They're sort of like earthquakes. They kind of happen. At least the main conditions which allow for revolutions to happen, one of which is the breakdown of the state. You can't engineer that very easily. And the states in the Atlantic world, at least, I don't see any circumstances in which that breakdown is on the cards right now. Given the greater, the deeper social base of these states than the Russian or the Chinese, given the greater strength of these states, I mean, if you look at Libya right now, Gaddafi is holding on to power simply through, I mean, this is Libya, this isn't even Egypt. It's just through military force. And he has a ragtag army, but he's able to hold on through military force. One imagines if the British or the American state were trying to hold on to power, what they would be capable of. That being the case, I think a ruptural logic within advanced capitalism really sort of right now is more it's something you talk about in a cafe or in a seminar room. It's not really a practical political program. Which means where we are right now is not in a good place. I'm not going to end with a way out or something like that. I think that's, I don't have any more knowledge of that than anybody else over here. But I would think that the first place to start was with a very frank assessment of where we are. And I think this is where we are right now. Tomorrow I'll give you some reason to feel that even though these varieties of socialist experiments failed, there's still something to be said for the underlying social theory that generated them, which is Marxist theory. And I'll do that through a defense of through some versions of Marxist theory against post-colonial criticisms.